Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Hello, Tom. How are you today?
I'm doing good this morning.
It looks dark outside. Is it that early for you?
No, not quite. It's just a little rainy.
It's a little bit rainy. And today we are joined by Alex Pollitt. Did I say that right?
Yep.
Okay, good. Who is in Sheffield, but has an image in his background of south of San Jose. I don't know. I thought Sheffield was a beautiful place, but you know. What am I going to say?
Sheffield's a beautiful place, but I'm currently in a basement in quarantine.
Oh, I see. I see. So that's really sad. I'm sorry.
All right.
So today we're talking about container networking. And we're going to start with, I think the best place to start actually is just to talk about what's wrong with container networking, right? I mean, why is it that container networking might even be a problem? I know most network engineers think container networking is a problem, so we don't really have to guess about what people think about it. So, Alex, why do you think container networking is where it is, or was where it was, or something like that? Why did it start where it started?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's evolved a lot over the last 5-6 years. Certainly when the container community first started building things like Docker and working out how they were going to network it, a lot of the people who were building that networking had never built networks before and didn't really understand networking. So they researched some tools, put some things together, it vaguely worked, and they thought that was good enough. There was another group of people who would come in and say, no, that's not good enough. That's not how you build a network. But then they bring in, if you like, the baggage of that first phase of virtualization when we literally took how you built enterprise networks in the physical world and created virtual devices and topologies of networks in the virtual world. And they tried to carry that over into container networking. So that was also a bit of a painful thing, particularly when you think of containers. One of the exciting things about containers is to increase the agility, right? So the idea that you'll have them dynamically scheduled anywhere in your cluster, that gets really hard if you bring in outdated network assumptions.
So this seems to me like the same situation we often have where people get into building something or designing something, and they kind of understand things at a surface level, but they don't really understand things at a deep, deep level. Why are things done the way they're done? What happened that caused BGP to be done a certain way, or it caused, you know, NAT to be used in a certain place or something like that? They just said, here's a problem I got to solve. I got a hammer. I'm going to take this hammer and I'm going to go around and find nails until I get the problem solved that I want to solve. Is that kind of a fair assessment of where things started?
I think it was. And I think it was the hammer was just random. Right. Let's see how networking is done. Oh, there's hammers. Let's use hammers.
Yeah. Well, it's the easiest tool to learn in the toolbox. In theory, that's not really true, but that's what people think when they get into carpentry. They use a hammer for everything.
Yeah. So the network equivalent in container land was a bridge.
Yeah.
You put all of your containers on a bridge, and then bridges are magical, and networking happens. And you know, there is some truth to that, but it's not necessarily the best way of building a container network.
Yeah, right. Tom, you were going to jump in there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, maybe it would be helpful to look at the history of container networking. What was the first construct? My first touch with containers a long time ago was the first thing I noticed as a network person is there's a lot of mangling going on in IP tables here, and I don't think I like it. Was my first reaction, but I'm not sure that was necessarily the first instantiation of container networking. Like, where did it start? With which constructs did it start?
I think it started in a sense almost without networking. So you used port mapping. So all of your containers were effectively sharing the host's network namespace, its IP address, and then you'd use port mapping.
So just using the vBridge that's in a Linux machine natively between the namespaces or something like that, and not really thinking about networking per se, just can we get packets to flow over what's already there?
Yeah, can we get packets to flow over what's already there? And just thinking, I mean, you can build a network that way, right? And you can actually, if you're automating it, you can build it to pretty high scales by using lots of port mapping. The downsides is that it's unfathomable to anybody to actually look at it and inspect it and be able to say whether it's in the state you expect it to be, because it doesn't look like a real network. So you can get your packets to flow and you can get your applications to work. So these folks building the first container networking, that's what they did, and it worked. But then when you start thinking about diagnosability and familiarity and compatibility with other networking tools, it was just a huge nightmare.
So I want to test one of my probably invalid assumptions. As I experienced Docker for the first time, I just thought to myself, this looks to me like a developer didn't want to bother somebody to deploy code on a server. They just wanted to do it on their laptop. And so I sort of theorized within myself, okay, well, if I was just doing something local, then this would probably be fine. Is that a correct assumption? And how did the builders of the container mindset, did they ever think that this would be used to deploy code into production? Was that part of the plan?
I believe that it was part of the plan. But if you take a company like Docker, they were very much oriented around the developer experience first. So they focused on how do we make this as accessible and easy for developers to use as possible. And then with the hope that in production, your operations engineers could basically use the same tools that the developer was using to replicate the experience in production. And you definitely did get a lot more portability, you know, with the whole container concepts and container images. It meant it was actually a lot easier to deploy things between, you know, if it works on your laptop, it'll probably work in production. If you ignore things like the network. But as you know, you can't really ignore the network.
All right. I saw a cartoon once that said it was two people sitting on a bench, and one of them says to the other, well, it works on my machine. And the other says, and hence containers were born.
Exactly.
So then what then was the next evolution beyond just port mapping? Just translating ports into internal networks. What happened next?
So the next, it was a while back, so I might miss out some of the steps. But for me, the most significant step was moving to a model where every container had its own IP address. Now, as you clarify that, because if you're familiar with Kubernetes, Kubernetes groups containers together into a pod, and that pod is the container that gets the IP address. So when I say every container gets an IP address, it's not literally ever. It's like every molecule of containers gets an IP address.
Okay.
And that then, made a big difference because you didn't need port mapping anymore, right?
Yeah.
And then you could start trying to build networks that looked a little bit more like networks. Now, the hammer that most people reached to again was a bridge,
a V-bridge inserted in the
magic happens.
Yeah, a V-bridge inserted in the cluster, right, in the Kubernetes cluster.
Yeah, so you'd have the Docker bridge running on every node in the cluster, and your containers would connect into the Docker bridge using virtual Ethernet pairs, and in that sense, it kind of looks like a real network. But if you think about it, what the actual requirements of the containers, it's exceptionally rare that containers would need L2 access rather than just L3 IP. So if you don't need L2, well, why do a bridge? Rather than bridging your traffic, you can, instead, the way to think of it is you're going to turn every one of your hosts into a virtual router and have your containers connect into the virtual router. And then we know how to build routed networks that scale. We've been doing it for years. They look familiar to anybody who's a network engineer. It's easy to see what's going on. You can use the same tools that you've always used to kind of inspect them or to adjust them. So that's basically what we did with the Calico open source project. So we had this philosophy right from the start that it was going to be pure L3, it was going to be routed, it was going to be a flat network with security done using network policies rather than security being done by the kind of topology of the network, which would be the traditional enterprise way of doing it. And there was a whole bunch of orchestrators back then. You know, there was Docker Swarm, Docker Compose, there was Mesos, and all the variations of Mesos and Marathon and all of that. And then there was Kubernetes. And it wasn't 100% clear which of those was going to become long-lived. One of the assumptions that Kubernetes defined very early on in its beginnings, before even the 1.0 release, was to say, yeah, every pod will have an IP address. It's going to be a flat network, which aligned very well with what we'd been evangelizing with Calico. And I think that is one small part of the reason why Kubernetes was successful.
Well, within the container, it's a flat bridge network. Or within, not within the container, within the pod, it's a flat bridge network. Within, between the containers, or between the pods, it's a routed network, correct? Is that still the way it is?
Yeah, and it's within the container, you don't really create a virtual bridge device. It's just that all of the things running in the container are running in the same network namespace. So the containers within a pod, you can think of them as being analogous to processes running on a host. They're running in that same network namespace, so they're sharing that copy of the network stack. So, you know, only one of them can listen on a particular port, and the others then can't listen on that port because you've only got one copy of the network stack.
Right. So that's, you're defining flat as they're sharing a namespace, not flat as in L2 adjacent to each other.
I was actually meaning flat as the kind of cross-cluster network, right? So, I mean, it doesn't have to be everything's in the same subnet, but conceptually, everything's in the same CIDR block, all of your pods, and there is no topology.
So it looks like a layer 2 network from the outside, but it's actually layer 3.
It's routed, yeah.
Yeah, it's routed, but it's routed. So what does this give you? I mean, normally in a routed network, I would think, and I actually have some other questions about the way the stack is built, but let's go here first. So when you, what does that give you? Because normally in a layer 3 network, you're going to have a default host. You're going to have a default gateway in your host, which is going to get you to somebody who knows everything because you don't have a routing table locally. And you're going to have a router that knows how to get to things. So does it matter whether it's in the same CIDR block or not? Because technically you're sending the packets to a default gateway that's then mirroring or sending them back in some way to the other host in that network.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the nice things about L3 networks is we already know how to build them, and people have built them in various different ways. So when you go into an enterprise and they have a particular way they want to do it, you can usually be compatible with that. Not always, but usually.
Okay. So packets do go through a default gateway between the clusters, or do they go directly across some sort of an Ethernet like bus, or how does that piece work?
Yeah. So from the pod's point of view, they have a default gateway. I'll use Calico as the example.
Let's put all this in the context of Calico, because we're actually talking about Calico here, basically, is what we're getting into. So
cool. Yeah. So they have a default gateway, which effectively is the virtual router that Calico is running on the host that's hosting the pod. Now, that virtual router is just the Linux kernel and the standard Linux routing table. So there's nothing magical about it. It's just Calico is making sure the right routes are programmed in to the Linux so that it knows how to behave like a router. So obviously there'll be /32 routes to each of the pods that are hosted locally on that host. And then there will be routes to the pods on the rest of the network. How the routes to the pods on the rest of the network work is pretty flexible. So if you're running, say, in a private cloud or on-prem data center, Calico can learn those routes by talking BGP to your top-of-rack routers, right? And then at that point, pods really do become first-class citizens in the underlying network. Now, that's just one way of doing it, and it's a way that is very popular on-prem. In the cloud, you can't always necessarily do that, and maybe you have to treat the underlying network as an L2 network, and then the routes are just being exchanged between the Calico nodes rather than with the underlying network. Or maybe you even want to run an overlay network of some sort, where again, there's a range of ways that you could choose to share the routes around the cluster. But fundamentally, what you're always doing is just programming routes into the Linux kernel. So the network always looks kind of like a proper network and is always easy to understand.
So you're using host routes to get to devices, different clusters within the same physical server, right? And then you're using what would be considered a CIDR block or a subnet or a reachable destination, a prefix length, prefix pair to get outside of that physical host, essentially, is what you're doing in Calico. That's the kind of the way people normally set it up. Now, you could do everything as host routes,
yep,
which would be the alternative, right?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that Calico is able to do with its IP address management is to use IP address management information to aggregate routes so that typically each host would only have to advertise one, maybe two routes that are aggregate routes of /26s or something like that, that cover all of the pods that are running on that host.
Okay.
And that massively simplifies the number of routes that you're communicating around the network to what's, you know, an absolutely trivial load for even the most basic, you know, white box routers.
And so those routes are automatically, those aggregates are automatically generated how? Through the IP management system or just by examining what's in the local table?
Through the IP management system.
And
examining what's in the local table as well.
Okay, so it's both.
So it won't, if there's no pods on a node, then it won't advertise anything, even if that node has normally been allocated some IP addresses it can use. But as soon as there's one IP address allocated from within that /26, then it'll advertise the whole of that /26.
So is it pretty well assumed that in a deployment like this, you're going to be running some sort of dynamic routing protocol between the host and the top of rack switch? Is that kind of a baseline expectation?
Yeah, it's definitely for an on-prem type of deployment, that's by far the most popular way of doing it. Like I say, you don't have to do that. You can run overlay network modes, and Calico supports VXLAN and IPIP. Also supports WireGuard, which you can effectively use as an overlay network that has encryption. So all of those are options. And in those overlay things, you don't need to worry about using a standards-based protocol because you're not talking to other equipment. And one of the nice things about the Kubernetes data model is it's actually very easy for every Calico node to have full visibility to where all of the pods are across the whole of the cluster.
So where's the dividing line? Where does Kubernetes end and Calico begin? What's the how are duties divided?
Yeah, so Kubernetes does come with some very basic networking that's kind of baked in called KubeNet, but it's rarely used because it's very basic and it kind of relies on you doing other things outside of it to make it all hang together. So what's much more common is people will plug in their own network implementations into Kubernetes using CNI, Container Network Interface, API. So it's a standard API that Kubernetes supports, and Calico and, you know, at least a dozen other implementations support that API. So users can choose which network plugin they want to use.
Okay, so I think this is important. Actually, we kind of stepped into Calico without talking about Calico itself and how it plays a role in the Kubernetes ecosystem. So why don't you explain a little bit what Calico is, and so now we can kind of give context to the prior discussion of what Calico is doing.
Yeah, So Calico is an open source project for networking and network security. I'll say for Kubernetes. The technology was originally designed to be broader than that, and so started with OpenStack. But essentially, the principles are identical. But Kubernetes is the mainline use case today. So it will provide your pod networking for all of your pods within a cluster, and it will also provide network policy enforcement, which is the way that you do network isolation and security within the pod network.
That's what you meant when you were saying instead of using the network topology to enforce security, you just use Calico itself, right?
Yeah, you use network policy, exactly.
So the way Kubernetes works is you have a networking plugin. So originally Kubernetes, the network was just part of Kubernetes. There was no plugin. It was just you run Kubernetes, you just get networking. That's what you get. But I think at some point they broke it off and split the networking subsystem out. So it's now a plugin. So what Calico does is it replaces the Kubernetes networking plugin with a different one that gives you a lot more capabilities. It converts from a layer 2 view of the world to a layer 3 view of the world, as we've been discussing, and gives you security. So let's talk about the security a little bit, because that's interesting. So are we talking micro-segmentation via not advertising routes? Are we talking about something like IP tables being automatically populated on the host level? Or how does the security in Calico work from an outside perspective?
Yeah, okay. I'll start with a little bit more context around what network policy is. So Kubernetes provides a network policy API. So you use standard Kubernetes tools to create network policies. Kubernetes itself does not enforce network policies and relies on the network plugins to do that. And the network policy API was defined within the community, widely agreed and supported. Now, most plugins only support a subset of it. Calico supports every feature and was actually used as the reference implementation during the initial development. And how you implement it is kind of up to the network plugin, right? So you could do it by saying, hey, I'm going to withdraw routes so it's not routable. In Calico's architecture, we made a very conscious decision to keep isolation separate from reachability as kind of domains of concern. And that's allowed us to run Calico across a whole range of different networks, including ones where we have very limited control on how the network behaves. So we wouldn't have been able to do security by withdrawing routes. So in Calico, we always set up the routes so that, in theory, every pod can talk to every other pod, right? That's the flat network. Then we layer on the network policy enforcement on top of that, which you can think of as being analogous to putting a virtual firewall on the virtual interfaces that go to the pods, which is dynamically configured in real time based on the policy that you've defined in the cluster.
So then would you define, so what's the smallest domain, what's the smallest segment size? Is pod the smallest unit you can protect, or can you protect per container?
Pod is the smallest unit that you can protect, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned earlier that there was an API. Is that API, is it Kubernetes that has the API and then the network plugin speaks to the API, or does Calico host the API?
So Kubernetes network policy is a standard resource that's hosted by Kubernetes API server. But all that the Kubernetes API server does is store that data. And then the network plugins plug in and they read that data and say, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing with network policy. So that's Kubernetes network policy, right? And then some plugins also have their own network policy that can go beyond or have a different paradigm than Kubernetes network policy. So Calico has Calico network policies, and you can interleave them and run them alongside Kubernetes network policies if you want to. And Calico network policies add additional features that aren't in Kubernetes network policies.
So what kind of policies are these? So Tom asked about IP level versus port level. So they're IP level, they're not port level. Are they simply allow deny, or is there stateful inspection, like not allowing a TCP session to be sourced or opened into a particular host, but only allow the host to source out TCP connections. Are there other policies like that that you can do as well? Or is it primarily just allow, deny, like an access list sort of thing?
We'll talk about the granularity first. Now, you can write network policies and put IP addresses in them if you want to, but it's quite rare to do that. Normally, what you would do to identify your workloads in network policies is to use what's called a label selector. So every pod that's running in the cluster has a set of labels that the person who's running it decided to label it with. And you use those to identify workloads in your policies. So the first selector in the policy basically says which pods should this policy apply to, right? As in, if you think about that virtual firewall in front of each of the pods, which virtual firewalls are going to get a copy of the rules in this policy, right? So you might have a label selector that says, I'm going to apply this policy to any pod that has color equals red, right? Then you can have one or more rules. They can be ingress rules or they can be egress rules. And they can say, okay, I'm going to allow ingress from any pod that has color equals blue as one of its labels. And these label expressions can be quite rich. So you can like use combinations of labels. But very often people will have a label, like they'll have an app equals label or something like that that they're using. So that's what gives you the flexibility, right? Because you could also, rather than, you know, color equals or app equals, you could have, I really like zone architectures. So I'm going to have zone A and B and C, and that's how I'm going to do my things. You'd probably be missing out there, because one of the nice things about the move to microservices is it's actually an opportunity to lock down and do network at a much finer granularity. As you moved away from monoliths, it's usually quite easy to describe, okay, which ports is this microservice expecting to receive traffic on and only allow ingress on those ports. And then if you're building an application out of microservices, you can probably reasonably easily articulate, okay, which other microservices are consuming this one, and I'll give them an appropriate label so that they're allowed in and nothing else is.
So it sounds like it's quite a bit abstracted from IP by design.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Application.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the nice things about that is if you think about, sometimes you hear it called shift left security practices, where you're trying to get security done earlier in your kind of deployment chain rather than waiting for the security team to do it at the end. And with the move away from needing to be a networking expert to do security, it actually means that, you know, the developers or the service owner teams or the ops team, they're in a position to define these network policies really without knowing anything about how networking works.
So is there any notion? So this is, when you think about this in a closed ecosystem, this is really great. But unfortunately, the real world has to touch it at some point, right? The outside world that doesn't know or care about Kubernetes is going to have to send packets. So in the case of interop with other networks, how does Kubernetes deal with this? Can you classify external networks and give them a label or something like that? Or how does it interact?
In Kubernetes network policy, that's where you would potentially put in IP addresses or IP address ranges to represent that external entity. Calico has some features beyond that. So one of the things that Calico has is, for example, the concept of a network set, which is where you can give a group of IP addresses or a group of IP address ranges and say, treat them as if they have these labels. And then from the point of view of network policy, it's still written in labels. Now, you still need somebody to populate that network set with the right IP addresses, but it makes it a lot easier to combine. And then you can have tools, for example, in Calico Enterprise, which is a commercial product made by Tigera that kind of builds on top of and around Calico open source. One of the things it can do in network sets, for example, is populate them with IP addresses from various threat feeds. And then you can just consume those in your network policies using whatever label schema you've defined for yourself.
So let's talk a little bit about the Calico community and understanding about, you know, where it is and stuff like that. Now, I know that your company, Alex, is deeply involved in Calico, correct?
Yeah.
How large is the community? How active is the support? Because this is something I always ask about open source projects, and I try to evaluate them and understand them. How many contributors? How do you have weekly meetings? How many people attend? You know, that kind of stuff. I mean, is it an active community?
Yeah, it's reasonably active. I mean, I wouldn't put it in the same bucket as, say, something like the Kubernetes community, which is massively active. But the Calico community is reasonably healthy. We do monthly community meetings. There's not tons of people turn up to them, but people dip in and out. And then we typically will have maybe a dozen external contributions in flight at any one time on the project. And some of those might take a couple of weeks to get through, and some of them might be harder and take a couple of months. But yeah, there's definitely external people contributing, which gives it a health beyond if it was only the Tigera folks who are contributing to it.
How does the community make architectural decisions, like the big questions? How do they handle it?
Yeah, most of those we kind of made a long time ago, so there's not really been very many of those. The definition of Kubernetes network policy was an example where we already had a policy language, but the community wanted a standard one. Now, obviously, that was broader than just the Calico community. That impacted all of the network plugin communities. But that was probably the last big thing that needed extensive community discussion. You know, when we started off with Calico, half the people thought we were crazy, right? So it's kind of like, all right, well, we'll just build it the way we think we should. And, you know, years later, everybody's like, well, of course, that's how you should build it. But all those decisions were taken years ago.
Okay. So, I'm wondering about things like future security stuff and things like that, how those might be handled.
We have some security engineers on the team. We have various bug bounties out there and processes for dealing with vulnerabilities that we find. So all of that stuff kind of happens in the following the kind of standard processes you'd use for open source. So that's all good. There are still some fairly significantly large developments going on. So, you know, one other decision we made very early when we were designing Calico was to have a clean separation between, if you like, the control plane logic and the data plane logic. Even though we're using the Linux kernel as our data plane, we have a pluggable data plane driver. So our first driver used the standard Linux network pipeline with, you know, standard routes, IP tables for the policy enforcement. We then wrote a Windows driver that uses the Windows primitives. We released this year an eBPF-based driver. So if you're on the very latest kernels and you really care about getting those tiny little extra bits of performance out, then eBPF is there. And right now we have, it's currently in incubation status, but we have VPP data plane, which is getting pretty close to completion. So that's, you know, that's another exciting development. And, you know, the VPP stuff is like 99% of that is being done by non-Tigera people.
Nice. That's a testament to the modularity and pluggability of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've always had a philosophy of trying to use the best tool for the job. And if that tool changes over time, then we'll use the better tool when it comes along.
Cool. So are there labs, like if somebody wanted to get involved in, well, even beginning by learning this stuff, are there labs? Like obviously it's on Git, so you can download a containerized, apparently, I would guess it's also in the Docker store, so you can download it and play with it on your own computer if you wanted to, with a local Docker environment.
How do you start learning this stuff? And are there any resources to help people kind of quick start?
Yeah. So the Calico docs site is actually pretty good for a quick start of getting going with Calico. So one of the things that we've done in the Calico docs is, for example, All of the install guides are oriented around your platform and your environment, right? Because otherwise what you end up with is an install guide that's 20 pages long and says, oh, if this, then do this, if that, then do this other thing. Because we always want to install what's going to be the optimum network for the environment. So in the quick install guides, we have, are you using a hosted Kubernetes service like EKS, AKS, or GKE? Okay, here's the docs for how you get started on EKS. Here's the docs for how you get started on AKS. Are you managing cluster yourself in the public cloud? Which public cloud? Okay, here's how you get going. We're building your own cluster with Calico in AWS. Same for on-prem. And then we also have a guide called Calico the Hard Way, which is definitely not something you should try to do for production. But if you really want to get into the meat of how do all the components fit together and what's doing what, then that's a great guide for learning. We also have a certified training course for Calico that's about to be released, and that will be free. So it's available for pre-registration right now. Depending on when this airs, it may already be generally available. But that's pretty exciting. So it's self-paced online training, mixture of short videos giving background education around Kubernetes networking and around Calico. And then 80% of it is hands-on labs where you're actually like looking at, okay, how does a container look like when I see it from Linux? How does kubeproxy do its load balancing? Oh, what do Calico routes look like? How do I program a network policy? Can I see it's working? What's the best practice for network policy? And takes you through doing all of those things, switching on, saying, hey, I want encryption of all my traffic, so I'll switch on WireGuard. Hey, I want to run the very latest eBPF features, so switch on eBPF. And then we'll show you some of the differences that makes to the networking and leave you in a position where you'll be in a place where you can judge, okay, which of these things do you want to leverage for yourself?
So one last kind of question is, how would this interact with something like FR routing or CRPD or a containerized routing stack, Viata or whatever it is?
I mean, to be honest, we don't really come across that kind of stuff too much.
Okay. I was just curious because, of course, that's the world I live in. So I'm very curious about, you know, could you put a containerized FR routing or CRPD or something in a container behind Calico and build a network where it would route type of a thing? I assume you could because it's layer three. It should just work as long as you're using BGP, not ISIs.
Yeah, there's some security issues you'd have with that, which pretty sure you could configure to switch off. But for example, one of the things that Calico will do by default is when a packet's coming out of a pod, it'll check like, okay, is that actually the packet's IP address or is somebody trying to compromise the system?
I see.
So okay. We do basically a reverse path filtering is how you can think of it. So you need to configure things sort of slightly non-standard. You could probably get it to work, but we don't really see very many people wanting to do that. The nearest thing would be, you know, some of the carriers, they have virtual network functions that they're running in container land. And sometimes their requirements will be, in addition to connecting to the pod network, they also need, say, an SRIOV interface going into the pod so they can get some really high throughput on a particular physical network, for example. So there are specialized use cases like that that you can build together. But those are the kind of 1% of users, I'd say.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, that's all I have. Thanks, Alex, for coming on and talking to us about Calico. I think it's a really interesting project, great open source thing that's going on right now in the networking world, and something network engineers need to pay attention to because it does impinge or impact what they're doing. So, Alex, where can people get in touch with you, follow your work? Are you blogging? Stuff like that.
So you can get in touch with me through Twitter. So my handle is LXPollet, or you can find me on Calico users Slack or Kubernetes Slack. You'll find me there in the same way.
Okay.
And always happy to chat with people and connect and point them in the right direction.
Awesome. And Tom, where can people get in touch with you other than your non-existent blog? It's never going to end, man.
It will never end. It will never end. I am on LinkedIn. Just find me by searching for my name, Tom Ammon. And Twitter is the same, Tom Ammon.
All right, cool. I'm Russ White. You can always find me here at The Hedge and on rule11.tech and LinkedIn and I don't know, wherever else you can find me. Who knows? Thanks for joining us and catch you next time on The Hedge.
Subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.